Welcome to another Weber Training Teleclass, Emerging Threats to Public Health, Miracles, Myths, and Mistakes. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I will thank you again for joining this teleclass today. And a special welcome, of course, to those of you who are joining this as your first teleclass. There are many of you, and I'd like to welcome you all. Dr. Paul Sockett is the Director of Foodborne, Waterborne, and Zoonotic Infectious Diseases Division for the Center for Infectious Disease Prevention and Control. As a member of our teleclass faculty, Dr. Sockett ranks among the veterans. This is, I think, his third or fourth teleclass lecture. Each one has been fantastic, and this one looks to be the best yet. He's certainly covering a lot of ground, from the plague in 2000 BC to modern climate change. So to give the teleclass, Emerging Threats to Public Health, Miracles, Myths, and Mistakes from the Center for Infectious Disease Prevention and Control in Ottawa, Canada, it is my honor to once again present Dr. Paul Sockett. Paul.
Thank you very much indeed for your welcome, and my thanks again for the opportunity to present today on the factors I believe have and currently are influencing the public health environment. I'd also like to express my thanks to Ms. Teresa Wilk for her help in creating the slides that you will be looking at this afternoon and in helping me compile the information which I will be presenting. I must stress that the views expressed in this lecture are my own and are not necessarily those of either Health Canada or the Public Health Agency of Canada, although most of what I will say will be focused on infectious diseases. As well, many of the issues identified do have wider public health implications. Today's lecture really falls into two parts. In the first, I will provide a historical perspective on the development of public health, and the second will examine within that perspective some of the current emerging threats that we're trying to deal with today. Now, there's nothing new to the concept of emerging public health threats, and what we perceive as a threat is influenced not only by the newness of the threat, but also its occurrence in time and place. My own passion for public health was born out of my father's stories about life in a small South Wales mining community in the early decades of the 20th century, one of which I actually spent many pleasant years of my childhood throughout my summer holidays. But largely through his recollections, I've been able to witness the impacts of epidemics of measles, diphtheria, tuberculosis, the horrors of mine accidents, the chronic effects of pneumoconiosis, and the impact of inadequate housing or damaged environments on a population which lived without social and health service safety nets, which are enjoyed by most of the modern industrialized countries today. Yet what he described is not so different from the conditions which continue to exist in many parts of today's world. What that generation did not realize was that a revolution in both public health and health care was taking place that within a few generations would dramatically reduce disease and increase their life expectancy. However, the very success achieved through concerted actions on the population as a whole to reduce the impact of disease, together with the improvements in diagnostic and therapeutic approaches aimed at the individual, has taken the focus off public health somewhat, I believe, during the last 3 to 4 decades. Of course, there are notable exceptions to this, which include efforts to reduce smoking, especially in young people, and, for example, mass screening campaigns for the early detection and treatment of breast cancer. However, new impetus to public health in recent years has been driven mainly by infectious disease threats emerging outside of our Western industrialized nations. At the same time, the focus for public health response has moved from the local to the regional to the national and now to the international stage. So if we'd like to turn to slide 2, an important early indicator of success in the improvement of health of the public is in fact the increase in life expectancy that occurred in the Western industrialized nations following organized societal efforts to address issues around living and working conditions that took place in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, particularly in Europe and more specifically in the United Kingdom. And as this slide shows in the United Kingdom, for example, between 1901 and 1951, the cumulative effects of these activities, which included sanitary improvements, water treatment, legislation for improved living and working conditions, improvements in nutrition, particularly for children, and education, resulted in an increase in life expectancy of about 20 years over that period. Over the next 10 years, this increased again by a further 10 years. Perhaps if we turn to the next slide, number 3. Other developed nations have seen a similar steady increase in average life expectancy since the beginning of the 20th century. Even in the last 50 years in the United States and Canada, like the UK, have seen an increase of about 10 years in average life expectancy. Similar patterns, although more dramatic, are being seen in major developing regions of the globe, particularly India and China. One concern, of course, however, is that Africa continues to lag well behind this, probably reflecting the poor public health infrastructure which exists in many parts of that continent. The increase in life expectancy in the UK, for example, was not only one of the miracles of the development of public health. Probably more significant was the improvement in the quality of life which people enjoyed. Although a more difficult concept to explain, nowadays we can use the Disability Adjusted Life Year, or DALY, which is a complex indicator of impact of disease, injury, and early death. Nevertheless, observed decreases in poverty, improvements in working conditions and housing, universality of education, the need to provide for leisure activities are all indicators of the change in quality of life that took place during the early part of the 20th century in the UK and other industrialized nations. A key driver of this development, of course, of the modern public health approach was the Industrial Revolution itself. Not in the sense that it provoked a sudden change in society, but rather that it initiated a process influenced by a number of factors which changed totally the previous medieval mechanisms for production and distribution of wealth. However, the impacts of the Industrial Revolution, which began in the UK in the latter half of the 18th century, brought about profound social and democratic changes, which in turn had significant impacts on the health and later public health of the nation. If you turn to slide 4, not the least of these impacts was increased population size and increased urbanization. The concentration of populations into urban settings, together with poor living and working conditions, inevitably seems to have given rise to increases in the diseases which thrive under such environments, and in turn influence the drive to reduce the impact of disease. So the period from the mid-19th century to pre-World War II saw the most dramatic increase in urbanization in the United Kingdom. Although at a lesser pace, the trend continues right up to today. Prior to the 19th century, most of the population was rural, with a relatively small proportion living in large towns and cities. If you move on to slide 5, the need to take public health action to reduce the impacts of disease in society and in these settings is, of course, nothing new. And the impact of infectious diseases is historically documented to a greater and lesser extent. And although the term plague may have referred to many diseases, including bubonic plague, smallpox, cholera, and possibly others, at least two major epidemics or pandemics of likely Yersinia pestis or bubonic plague are recorded. Obviously, the further back in time you go, the greater the difficulty in substantiating the cause of these diseases. But it's clear from books like the Bible, from historical literature and artifacts, that societies at the community level took at least some level of organized action to limit the disease spread within their communities. Often this took the form of some sort of quarantine action. However, let's move on to the 17th century and the next slide, number 6. In the mid-17th century, a man by the name of John Graunt was given the responsibility of collecting weekly data on the cause of death in the London parishes in England. This, in turn, became the weekly bill of mortality and was used by the government of the day to assess the impact of plague. And if you look on the slide, there are some really quaint descriptions of causes of death. Everything from people dying of fright and gout through to plague itself. And that particular week, as you'll notice, there were out of the 5,568 causes of death recorded in those parishes, 4,237 of them were due to plague. This gives a stark illustration of the impact of plague on that society. In fact, this is, I believe, one of the worst weeks of that plague epidemic. However, this bill of mortality went on to become the progenitor of a national system for monitoring morbidity and mortality, which continues in the UK today and has influenced the keeping of similar statistics in many other countries around the world. And if, for example, you turn to slide 7, it's clear that these early statistics contributed at least to some extent to response to the plague, as these four pictures indicate, either in leaving the affected area by boat or by walking or on horse if you were poorer, which probably contributed in turn to its further spread, through to the last two, managing the disposal of bodies. One particularly interesting feature of the second picture on this page is the two guards with spears trying to prevent people leaving London from entering their village and thereby bringing the plague with them. Moving on to slide 8, we even find in the writings of Sir William Petty an early rudimentary attempt to provide a cost-benefit analysis of making attempts to preserve the lives of working people, and in this case for economic reasons, and something we'll come back to later on in the lecture. So in his Treatise of Lessening Ye Plague of London, William Petty said that given the value of an individual and the cost of transporting people outside of London and caring for them for 3 months, thus increasing the probability of survival, every pound expended would yield a return of £84. And of course, in those days, that was a very considerable sum of money. Moving on now to slide 9. A second but very important event, which now occurred in the 19th century this time, was John Snow's investigation of a cholera outbreak in South London, which identified the cause as water accessed by a pump in one street called Broad Street. Although the outbreak was already declining at the time he removed the pump handle, and therefore, as many believe, did not exactly stop the outbreak, his approach to the investigation, through the systematic collection and analysis of data, and even literally going from house to house, using geographic information approaches, either plotting the data out on a map, followed by public health action in terms of removing the handle off the pump, has become a model for public health action ever since. In slide 10, we turn to a third event, which was to influence the public health movement, and that was the popularization of smallpox vaccination. Now, prior to Edward Jenner, other approaches and local use of cowpox pustules in 1774 to inoculate individuals has in fact been documented, particularly in the UK. And particularly one local farmer in southern England by the name of Benjamin Jesty has a well-documented claim as being the first person to use a reproducible technique for vaccinating individuals using material from cowpox pustules and based on his observations about milkmaids and their resistance to smallpox because of their exposure through cowpox. However, I think Jenner's fame is justifiably that he popularized and made acceptable the use of a vaccine which ultimately led to the elimination of the smallpox virus by 1977, well, at least outside of the laboratory. This was arguably the first successful internationally coordinated public health action. The result was twofold. First, the eradication of smallpox itself is a modern miracle and is demonstrated on the slide that you have in front of you. The second was the demonstration that a coordinated international efforts can be successful, leading to similar WHO-led approaches to eradicate diseases such as polio and measles. At around the same time as all this was going on, a naval surgeon by the name of James Lind, again in the UK, was in the process of establishing that the simple use of fresh fruit, particularly citrus fruits, and vegetables will eliminate scurvy and seamen on long voyages, thereby laying the foundations for rapid growth in international exploration and international trade. However, Lind himself was not the first to propose the use of fresh vegetables and citrus fruits on long voyages. He was aware himself that Dutch sailors had used them for decades. He was also aware of the writings of Captain George Anson, who commanded a small British fleet in the Pacific in the 1740s. Now, Anson, like many people who traveled long distances in those days with crews of seamen, found that very quickly those seamen deprived of fresh fruit and vegetables succumbed to a number of diseases and their health declined rapidly. He landed on an island which was then made famous under the name of the book Robinson Crusoe, where he found fresh fruit and vegetables and discovered that once his crew were given these fresh fruit and vegetables, they extremely rapidly, almost miraculously, recovered their health. And he certainly recorded this in a number of documents. However, Lind, in his 1754 paper entitled A Treatise on the Scurvy, used the scientific approach to establish the link. Unfortunately, the British Admiralty did not accept his recommendations until 1795, considerable time later, and unfortunately a year after Lind himself had died. Looking then to slide 11, by the time of the Industrial Revolution in Europe and later in North America, a number of factors had emerged which resulted in the ravages of diseases such as smallpox, measles, pertussis, diphtheria, tuberculosis, polio, as well as the effects of malnutrition and other things. Effectively, neither municipalities nor national governments could cope with the sheer physical and social problems of urbanization. And these arose from the bullets identified on the slide. Obviously, the increase in the size of population, the concentration of those populations in urban settings, and more specifically, the rate in which that concentration occurred. Poorly planned and regulated building of homes leading to crowding and poor living conditions, increased poverty in many urban concentrations, poorly regulated work conditions, and increased international trade, putting pressure on industrial organizations to produce more quickly and more cheaply. If we turn to slide 12, however, the drive to address these issues was not so much altruism, although I don't want to play down the work of reformers during the 19th and early 20th centuries, but rather more pragmatism. Edwin Chadwick, in his report on the conditions of the working people in the United Kingdom in the 1830s, took the view that improving the health of the working population had a good economic foundation. And this is an argument that was not missed by later analysts, and proponents of public health action, including Gary Calkins in the United States in the late 19th century when he was advocating for sanitary improvements in some of the cities of the United States, and Sidney Chave in the United Kingdom when he was commenting on the establishment and the importance of the medical officer of health in terms of delivering public health to the community. So then in slide 13, we find a second set of factors which also converged to animate the development of public health. These factors were based on the realization that diseases had specific identifiable causes and could be prevented at the population level by specific actions. And that society as a whole, and politicians in particular, had strong imperatives to improve health through coordinated systematic approaches. Thus, by the first decades of the 20th century, the cumulative effects of legislation on working and living conditions, nutrition and education and welfare was resulting in impacts on the incidence and prevalence of, for example, childhood diseases. Looking then at slide 14, thus we see measles deaths in the United Kingdom were already declining markedly long before universal vaccination of children was introduced. This does not mean that fewer children actually got measles, only that fewer died of its effects. The same trends were also true of many other diseases at around about the same time, including tuberculosis, typhoid, pertussis, and others in the United Kingdom. Therefore, by the time we reach slide 15, we see the later introduction of vaccine in the 1960s and again in 1996 for measles, and its almost universal use in preschool children has all but eliminated the disease in many countries. This particular slide illustrates the situation in Canada, where cases declined steadily to almost zero following the introduction of vaccination in the 1960s, compared to the annual average of about 47,000 cases between 1924 and 1959. The decline in both the impact and incidence of infectious diseases resulting from initially improved living conditions and nutrition, and later by introduction of antibiotic therapy and universal vaccination for childhood diseases in industrialized countries, led eventually, I believe, to a complacency towards these diseases. If you turn to slide 16, it's my belief that this shift resulted in two mistakes in the period of the 1960s through to the 1980s, which have had far-reaching impacts. First of all, to underestimate and undervalue the impact of public health approaches, leading to a comparatively greater focus on individual healthcare delivery. And secondly, to assume that in our developed society, the impact of infectious agents is contained. Even to the point where in the 1960s, the Surgeon General for the United States was able to make the statement, the book on infectious diseases can be closed. The lie to the underlying beliefs behind these mistakes is demonstrated by numerous issues, I believe, not in the least being that we cannot ignore the burden of these diseases in less developed countries, that we're literally only a plane journey away from these diseases, and more immediately, the emergence of a number of so-called new diseases in the last three decades has, I think, begun to change our focus once again. So we see in slide 17, and I'm not going to go through this in great detail, a number of diseases which have emerged in the late 20th century. Now, this is not a complete list by any means, and is just meant to illustrate some of the types of diseases which include bacteria, viruses, and protozoal diseases for this presentation. Of particular interest is the number of infections which are actually or probably zoonotic in origin. Second, and not detailed on the slide, but mentioned at the bottom, is the emergence of multiple antibiotic-resistant strains of pathogenic microorganisms. Now, our understanding of what an emerging threat is, I don't believe is that well defined, but seems to be related largely to the demonstrated increase in incidence of a disease or prevalence of a health condition in a population. The disease or a condition such as diabetes may be something newly described or be re-emergence of a previously recognized condition in a new setting. And the recent description of previously hospitally acquired multiple antibiotic-resistant pathogens in community settings is probably one very real example of this. So turning to slide 18, I had, however, broadened the definition of emerging threats to public health the context of this presentation, not only to include infectious diseases, but also physical, human, and political and public sector environment factors. So the second part of today's lecture will consider these areas of threat to public health in a little more detail. Moving on then to slide 19, dealing first of all with the microbe and mechanisms for emergence. The term emergence currently relates to a number of mechanisms by which existing diseases, recognized microbes or new pathogens impact human health. For example, if you turn to slide 20, these include recognized diseases such as West Nile virus, which has established itself in a new environment, that is the North American continent. Previously, this disease had consistently only been described in northeastern Africa, southeastern Europe, and the eastern Mediterranean, but not in North America. However, West Nile, in 5 years, now 6 years, has established itself west, right across the continent from the Atlantic seaboard, right across through to the Pacific coast, north into Canada, as far north as just beyond Edmonton, and has been detected now south into Central South America and the Caribbean region. Going on to slide 21, I think other important mechanisms include the reemergence or reintroduction of previously controlled diseases. So, for example, we see epidemic diseases such as cholera, typhoid, typhus, and measles, all reoccurring in disaster zones on the one hand, and on the other hand, tuberculosis, specifically multiple antibiotic-resistant variants, occurring in subpopulations in the United States. And obviously, we have concerns about the emergence of those diseases consistently within Canada. The recent outbreak of Legionnaire's disease in a nursing home in southern Ontario, leading to a number of deaths, is a specific example of an environmental organism finding a new niche in the artificial environment of the cooling tower. Increased reporting of Lyme disease in the United States since the latter part of the 1970s and the recording of hantavirus pulmonary syndrome over the same period provide examples of diseases reflecting the potential impact on humans coming into increased contact with animal reservoirs of disease. There is also no doubt that pathogens lurking in animal, bird, or insect reservoirs do have the potential to cause public health concern. Most of these, including, for example, Ebola, Marburg, and Lassa fever, occur in sporadic outbreaks in developing nations. However, the potential for these diseases to move geographically via intermediate animal hosts, traveling human cases, or imported, either legally or illegally, animals cannot be underestimated. There have been a number of close calls in recent years, including Ebola-infected monkeys at a research facility at Reston in the United States, and detection of avian influenza H5N1 virus in an imported parrot last week in the United Kingdom. Both of these underlie the need for vigilance. On the other hand, the emergence of SARS in 2003 in China, its movement from fruit bats, now thought to be the possible source of origin, via secondary hosts, found in live food markets to humans, and then via infected humans traveling to Canada, reinforces the importance of international surveillance networks and international collaboration in identifying and controlling risks. The case of Helicobacter pylori, on the other hand, was a story of a known pathogen, then classified as Campylobacter pylori, looking for a specific pathology. Its linkage to stomach ulcers and stomach cancer further emphasize, I believe, the need for us to look closely at the potential microbiological origins of chronic disease conditions, and we're beginning to see more and more of that taking place. The role of microorganisms in serious debilitating or life-threatening conditions ranging from reactive arthritis and malabsorption of nutrients following salmonellosis to kidney failure, particularly in children resulting from veratoxin-producing E. coli infections, through to neurological and cognitive impacts of Guillain-Barré syndrome after Campylobacter infection or West Nile infection, are also important indicators of the need to explore these types of risks aggressively. Finally, for this slide, the ability of new pathogens to emerge as a result of genetic recombination resortment and selective pressures is of most current interest. The most obvious examples are emergence of antimicrobial resistant strains of bacteria and viruses. Resistant strains are now reported in the common groups of human pathogens. However, the levels of resistance and the ability to acquire and share resistance of multiple classes of drugs is challenging our approaches to antibiotic use, both in humans and in agriculture. And if we move to slide 22, I think this illustrates, however, the highest level of concern that we have currently, which is directed at the potential for genetic resortment of the avian influenza H5N1 virus to produce a pandemic strain directly transmissible between humans. The map overlays the known outbreaks of H5N1 in poultry with flyways for migrating birds, although the map, in fact, is now a little bit out of date because it doesn't show the more recent occurrences recorded in Romania, Turkey, Greece, and Croatia. But bird migration is only one possible mechanism for the spread of the virus and may have more relevance at a regional level than as an intercontinental mechanism of spread. However, I believe that the evidence on that one is still waiting to be gathered and confirmed. But certainly you can see from the map that there is potential for these major flyways to overlap, and certainly some of them do come across to North America. At the same time, they only tell part of the story, because the flyways don't indicate the smaller flyways within countries and the continents where birds may actually transmit disease readily by short-term migrations. And that's probably one of the mechanisms by which West Nile has spread in North America in the recent years. Nevertheless, the geographic spread of H5N1 in poultry inevitably increases the possibility of human exposure and of genetic reassortment evolving a highly transmissible pathogenic human strain. We move on to slide 23. The human environment issues present a second cluster of emerging public health threats. These include issues associated with population dynamics, population structure, and economic status. They're listed on the slide as five factors: population growth, age, movement, prosperity, and education. And due to time limitations, I'll limit comments today to the detailed comments today to the first three. That's growth, age, and movement. However, I believe it's important to note that improvements in prosperity and education are linked to improvement in health status. Overall, the number of individuals living in dire poverty worldwide has declined from about 1.5 billion in the early 1980s to an estimated 1.1 billion in 2001, and it's projected to fall lower over the next two decades at least. However, in themselves, these statistics only tell part of the story and partly reflect declining populations in key areas. More importantly, they also reflect a change in distribution in poverty. With the virtual elimination of extreme poverty in large parts of East Asia and the Pacific, but increased poverty, at least in terms of numbers of people affected, in sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean. These areas will therefore likely increase importance as sources of economic migration and from environments where local and public health infrastructure may in fact either be in decline or relatively non-existent. Looking at slide 24, we therefore see that world population itself is currently increasing and has grown from about 1 billion at the beginning of the 19th century to about 6 billion today. Current predictions indicate a world population of about 9 billion by the year 2100, although the range of projections is between 5 and 14 billion. However, one thing that all the projections do indicate is that there will eventually be a slowing down of world population growth. And a key and inevitable impact of this slowing down is going to be a shift in population age to a more elderly population, with all the implications this has for health and healthcare delivery, as well as causes of morbidity. This issue is no longer a projection for most of the older industrialized countries. So as we see on slide 25, for Canada itself, not only has the Canadian population more than doubled since 1951, but the proportion of individuals aged 35 to 59 years and 60 years plus is noticeably increasing. The inevitable outcome of this are increased demands for healthcare of the elderly, increases in age-related illnesses, and greater vulnerability to disease from decreasing immunity in an elderly population. So if we look now at slide 26, international travel and commerce have played historically also and continue to play an important role in the spread of disease. Currently, movement of people and goods around the globe are at historically unprecedented levels. Initially, I think it's worth pointing out that the spread of plague into Europe was linked to international trade in the 14th century, and no doubt people fleeing plague-infected areas further spread the disease. The influenza pandemic after World War I was probably spread in part by movement of soldiers and displaced persons. Certainly, malaria outbreaks which occurred in the southern United Kingdom after World War I were associated with returning malaria-infected troops. More recently, introduction of epidemic cholera into Central and South America in the early 1900s was probably linked to international cargo movement by ship. Turning to slide 27, these links between travel and commerce and imported infections are well illustrated by the list on this slide. In terms of the fear factor, probably SARS coronavirus infection was likely the most important, not only because of the seriousness of the disease, but also because of its rapid transportation via air from Asia, as well as the problems in containing the infection. These concerns are detailed in the Naylor report, which I'm sure many of you are aware of or possibly even familiar with, which itself highlighted public health infrastructure issues, which clearly affected the ability to respond to this disease. Turning to slide 28, interestingly enough, the issues encountered in responding to SARS in Canada almost mimicked the problems which exacerbated the last smallpox epidemic in Canada, which occurred about 120 years earlier, 1885. I'll just read them through for you. The index case arrived from another country, that is the United States, by means of mass transportation, in this case the train. The initial focus of spread was in fact in a hospital environment and then out into the community. Containment in the community itself was hampered by lack of public cooperation and compliance with quarantine orders. There was insufficient public health and infectious disease infrastructure to cope with the epidemic within the municipalities affected. Controversy over the safety of the vaccine led to a suspension of its use at a critical point in time and was ultimately responsible for a very large number of deaths in certain segments of the population. and a large proportion of children were unvaccinated, and anti-vaccination hysteria resulted from poor communication on adverse reactions. So at the end of the day, the situation resulted in a very high proportion of deaths. 97% of all deaths occurred in the Catholic population of the area, although they only accounted for 74% of the total population. And children accounted for 90% of all deaths, that is children under the age of 15 years. Population at that time was so frustrated with the public health and municipal response that they actually tried to lynch the medical officer of health, who only just managed to escape out of the back of his house in time. And to give you an idea of just how high public opinion was running at the time, public health officials were actually issued with revolvers to protect themselves when going from house to house to trace cases. In slide 29, we now turn in the human environment to immigration. The remaining section of the human environment issue relates to population movement, specifically via immigration, and economic migration is an important factor in population growth in some developed and industrialized countries. And as is the case in Canada, immigration is actively encouraged for demographic and economic reasons. However, the origins of immigrants into Canada has changed markedly since the 1960s. Whereas 40 to 50 years ago, 70% or more of immigrants were culturally European, the majority now originates from Asia, Africa, and Central and South America. This change inevitably leads to greater travel for family and commercial reasons with areas with different infectious disease issues, different to those currently part of the Canadian scene. Obviously, the need to take this into account becomes part of the emerging risk environment. Going now to slide 30, I think few would now disagree that the world is in a dynamic period of climate change. Northern climes are seeing unprecedented sustained increase in temperature, and extreme weather events appear to be more frequent and more severe. I was quite struck the other night, last night, when I watched a documentary on the whirlwind that the tornado that hit Edmonton several years ago, I think in 1987, by the sheer force of the and impact of that particular issue. However, we seem to be getting more and more used to seeing major weather events impacting our population. This year probably has to go down on record as one of the worst years ever in terms of environmental and climate initiated disasters. So, we're seeing unprecedented sustained increases in temperature. Extreme weather events appear to be more frequent and more severe. Overall temperatures worldwide have increased significantly, as shown on the far right-hand side of the slide. Not only have they increased, but the rate of increase itself appears to be increasing. Three issues then become very obvious. First are the impacts on the environment and therefore on human well-being that are related to climate change will almost inevitably begin to happen faster. And certainly that's an issue that I know is being faced by the populations in the north of Canada as permafrost melting and other issues occur up there. Secondly, these events and the effects that they trigger could be increasingly severe. And thirdly, such trends may be difficult to reverse, at least in the short term. So if you move to slide 31, what we see on this slide are details of atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases. The changes that we are seeing occurring in the climate appear to be linked to these greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere, some of which may well trace back to the Industrial Revolution, but are certainly being exacerbated by the spread of industrialization and urbanization today. The three gases particularly identified on the slide, carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide, are all found in low concentration in pre-industrial era ages. Others including chlorofluorocarbons, hydrofluorocarbon, and perfluoromethane have only been detected in recent decades. Their most troublesome feature is that they are chemicals which seem to have a prolonged atmospheric lifetime and are therefore going to be very difficult to eventually remove from the equation. Nevertheless, carbon dioxide emissions do appear to be the major driver of the trend. but predictions suggest that even major reductions right now in carbon dioxide emissions would take decades to kick in and reverse the effects that we're currently seeing beginning to occur. So in slide 32, climate change may impact public health in a number of different areas, including increased risk of skin cancer, injuries from natural disasters, changes in community ability to sustain food production. And in the area of infectious diseases, however, there are a number of effects which are of particular importance, which are identified on the following slide. From the purely Canadian perspective, then a number of these infectious disease priorities are probably linked to climate change, and they include diseases which we now have that could contribute to increased burden of illness, and enteric and waterborne diseases are a particular concern in that direction. Diseases which we have now that are severe or have potential to create a large burden of illness and that could increase as a result of climate change, and Lyme disease and West Nile virus would be examples of those. Diseases that we don't have yet, but that occur nearby in the northern United States, eastern equine encephalitis and St. Louis encephalitis. At this point in time, we only see very sporadic incursions of these diseases, but with climate change, these could become much more frequent events in the Canadian environment. Diseases that are completely exotic, but which we might see re-emerge or emerge here in focal or more widespread occurrences, and that would include diseases such as dengue and malaria. Certainly the commerce and the international travel between Canada and areas where malaria and dengue occur naturally occur on very frequent occasions, with large numbers of people going to those regions. We have the mosquito vectors in Canada which could transmit these diseases. Even here in the Ottawa area, have a history 150 years ago of the of malaria endemic in the Ottawa area. So the arrival and the establishment of these diseases in Canada is certainly very much on the cards with current climate change issues. And then, of course, there are all those surprises, those things which may happen which we just don't expect. And I guess West Nile virus certainly was one of those things that caught us by surprise. The arrival of SARS in Toronto and British Columbia, again, other recent examples. Turning then to slide 34, we look here at the physical environment, particularly in the areas of economic development and land use. So in addition to the environmental impacts of climate change, these economic activities relating to industry and land use do have the impact, the potential to impact public health. These impacts include the increased likelihood of direct contact with wild animals and their diseases. For example, we have hantavirus in deer mice and people clearing out their cottages and becoming infected from urine-infected and mice dropping infected dust. A few years ago, in the early 1990s, we had an outbreak of toxoplasmosis on Vancouver Island that was linked to mountain lion urine contamination of the reservoir serving the community that was affected. Going on to animal husbandry and agricultural land management practices, these may result in greater risk of human illness from infected animals and contaminated environments, and the tendency towards greater concentrations of animals in larger scale, more intense farming practices is obviously one way in which this impact could be increased. Two specific but very different examples also illustrate these dangers. The first was the emergence of variants Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in humans in the United Kingdom in the early 1990s, which was linked to the practice of utilizing nervous system tissue in animal remains, specifically sheep and cattle, recovered for use again in animal feed for bovines. The second relates to the contamination of water sources used to supply local communities. This is a real issue in areas of intensive agriculture, for example, in southern Ontario, where studies have shown strong association between E. coli cases and the density of cattle farming in those areas. Interestingly enough, the town of Walkerton was located in one of those high-risk areas, and the outbreak in Walkerton in 2000 was a severe reminder of such risks, with half the town population affected and several deaths from veratoxin-producing E. coli infection. Of course, children and elderly people were particularly at risk in that outbreak. Moving to slide 35, we now look at the technological environment, particularly technology and industry in terms of medical technology and developments in industrial and agricultural practices. And from the perspective of technology of industry, technology and industry, there's just a few things that I want to focus on here because of time issues. First, in the area of medical technology, I think there are four things that are driving emerging risks. First of all, the increase in transplantation of tissues and organs and its potential to expose recipients to disease risks. Most developed countries now have extensive tissue screening activities. The problem is the new condition, or one for which a screening test does not yet exist or is not in routine use, causing problems in transplantation recipients. In addition to the increasing transplantation surgery, cancer treatments, population aging, and diseasing affecting immunities such as HIV and AIDS is bringing about an increase in the number of individuals who are susceptible to infection as a result of declining immunity. Some projections would suggest that within a few years of now, as much as 25 to 30% plus of our population will have declined or lower levels of immunity for one or other of these reasons. Advances in laboratory diagnostic technology also interestingly pose risks as well as solving problems. For example, with the advent of technology providing rapid diagnostic testing at the bedside, there is a parallel need to ensure that this data is captured for monitoring, surveillance, research, evaluation, and prioritization purposes, both at the national and at the provincial and local levels. The concern here is that that information will not get captured. And finally, in this section, and already mentioned earlier on, is the widespread use of antimicrobial drugs. And the emergence of resistant strains to pathogenic microorganisms. The second area on this slide relates to industrial technology, and this, for example, includes areas such as food processing. Food processing issues relate really to the scales of production. Previous surveillance of foodborne disease outbreaks in Canada and the United Kingdom would suggest that outbreaks related to processed foods are, in fact, on the decline. However, with food processing concentrated in high-volume production sites, a mistake might be rare, but the result would be a very large, geographically widespread outbreak. One good example of this is an outbreak that occurred in Canada in 1998. This was linked to a prepackaged lunch product, resulting in over 800 salmonella cases spread over 10 provinces. I'd like now as well to turn to a bacterium which thrives in the microenvironment of an air conditioning system cooling tower, but which can also be equally at home in a poorly maintained shower system. Legionnaire's disease, first specifically linked to human illness in 1976, after an outbreak of atypical pneumonia at a Legion convention in Philadelphia, has since been particularly linked to poorly maintained cooling towers for industrial air conditioning systems. Most recently, over 100 cases, and I believe there's 16 or more deaths at a nursing home in Toronto, were infected from an air conditioning system. And the outbreak typically affected the most vulnerable, the elderly, and those weakened with immunity. And finally, in an area for which more information on risk is needed, that of occupationally acquired diseases. As industrial and agricultural processes and practices change, technologies change, so will the risks linked to these occupational exposures. And I don't believe at this point in time we have enough information on what these are likely to be and how they're likely to impact people. Turning to slide 36, we move on to the political and public sector environment. This environment incorporates risks to public health which relate largely to the perception of risk and the willingness to direct resources to address those risks. In recent decades, with advances in diagnostics and treatment technologies, the focus on healthcare delivery has increased and, to an extent, overtaken that of public health. That pendulum may have started to swing back in the wake of issues such as Walkerton, bioterrorism risks, SARS, and more recently avian influenza and the potential for pandemic influenza on the infectious disease side. And in North America, nutrition-related problems linked to obesity, heart disease, and so on may also be driving the public health agenda somewhat harder than they were a few years ago. I think the result is a growing political willingness to address health at the population level. However, public health has always been a human resource intensive arena, and my current concerns, particularly in Canada, relate to the availability of expertise. For example, many current senior public health experts will be retiring over the next 5 to 10 years, and there are already shortages of trained public health and laboratory professionals. Current issues also include access to key data and the legal ability or willingness to share information, as happened during the SARS crisis and certainly identified as a key issue in the Naylor report. In fact, the legal frameworks for data and information sharing now lag way behind the enabling information technology, which allows us to share this public health information and indeed data very rapidly indeed. There is also no doubt that in order to address public health risks, especially those due to infectious diseases, we must contribute to international identification and analysis of risk. In an environment of global movement and trade, Asia's public health issues today may literally be ours tomorrow. So, on the last slide, our focus for the future. Where do we actually go from here? Well, this last slide does not seek to provide answers for the many issues raised in this presentation, but rather attempts to provide some focus for key needs that should be addressed. Firstly, in the area of research. Research in the area of infectious diseases really needs to increase the focus on the mechanisms of emergence of new threats, in particular the influence of climate change on infection and non-infectious disease or injury issues. I think this is going to be important to increase our understanding of how zoonotic and vector-borne diseases emerge, what the impacts of climate change in terms of natural disasters is actually going to be, and provide for the planning to mitigate against those types of issues. In terms of resources, there is a need to recognize that expertise in public health incorporates a very broad range of medical, veterinarian, microbiologic, engineering, agricultural, occupational, statistic, and other expertises, and to ensure that the approach that we take to dealing with public health issues is a very holistic one which incorporates all the necessary expertises in dealing with that issue. The outbreak investigation in Walkerton for my own division was a very good example of this, where it very rapidly became obvious that just putting epidemiologists on the ground wasn't enough. We needed veterinarians to help us. We needed geographers, we needed hydrologists and water engineers in order to make sense of what had actually happened in that particular situation. In my opinion, there needs to be a national strategy to ensure this expertise will be available, and this strategy must include elements which encourage multidisciplinary approaches to problem solving, as well as ensuring options for advanced training are there. Obviously, this will require the necessary financial resources to support and achieve. Finally, I believe clear the rationales for surveillance will be needed both to ensure priorities identified and addressed. The development of surveillance networks will ensure relevant data and information is shared nationally and internationally in a timely fashion. This will be facilitated by the combination of innovative information technology and innovative approaches to data analysis. A prime example of this is the Canadian Network for Public Health Intelligence, which incorporates stakeholder networks into a data and information sharing environment, utilizing, for example, geospatial analysis and modeling approaches to identify and assess risks in an almost real-time way. This is as well as providing essential risk management tools available via the same portal. And it's interesting the kiosk, the Canadian Integrated Outbreak Surveillance Centre component of SINFI, is now rolled out right across the country and being utilised at the regional health authority level right across Canada. The basic approaches to public health, originally identified by people of the likes of Graunt, Farr, John Snow, James Lind, Edward Jenner, and a host of others, have actually changed very little. The major changes have been in creating technologies and approaches that enable information to be analyzed and shared very rapidly, indeed almost real time, and in the need to address issues not just from a national or a local perspective, but from a global perspective, and to do that in the most timely way possible. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sockett, for another outstanding teleclass lecture. I wanted to ask a question, or I guess seek your opinion. We periodically hear of movements against childhood vaccinations. Can you comment on that, and at what point this will impact our herd immunity on many of the diseases that we don't really see anymore?
Yeah, it really depends on the context of the anti-childhood vaccination activity. Where it impacts small communities, for example, there are some religious communities which refuse to vaccinate their children. In an environment in Canada where we try to give people freedom of belief and freedom of choice, the impact is likely to be relatively small and confined to those populations in terms of the children getting ill. Although, obviously, there is always the potential that it will spill out to unvaccinated people outside of those groups. And there are people in society who, for medical reasons, are unable to be vaccinated. And, of course, they would be at particular risk. However, overall, those issues tend to be relatively containable. The bigger concern would be if there was a broader anti-vaccination movement within the population. Certainly the risks of that occurring became very obvious in the United Kingdom back in the 1980s when there was a lot of resistance to pertussis vaccination. The result was some very major outbreaks of whooping cough, pertussis, in the young population, and the concurrent severe sequelae and in some cases death resulting from that. The issue here is that all would have been preventable had the levels of vaccination within the community been maintained at a higher level. And I do understand that some people have real concerns about vaccination, particularly relating to the adverse events. And that is a difficult one to deal with. But when one realizes that those adverse events occur 10 times more often than the actual effects of the infection itself, the severe effects of the infection itself, it does put that a bit in perspective.
Thank you. Now, just in a few quick moments, I'd like to comment. You have a book in the works. Can you give us a little information on what it will be and when it will be available?
Well, I'm working on it at the moment, and you've had a fair chunk of it this afternoon. we're planning to give it exactly the same title as this lecture, Emerging Threats to Public Health, Miracle Myths and Mistakes. Obviously, there will be a lot more detail on some of the historical perspective and some of the myths and mistakes that occurred in the past, as well as the ones that have occurred in more modern times. I hope, in fact, that it will actually have a fairly large chunk of historical perspective, because there's a lot of important issues relating to the development of the public health movement, which it would be too easy to lose sight of today, and much to our detriment if we do.
Will we see that in 2006?
I can't say when you're going to see it. I think it's more likely 2007 than 2006, but I'll keep you updated, Paul.
Time has come to say goodbye. Thank you again all for joining the teleclass today. A special thanks to Dr. Sockett for a very interesting presentation. Looking forward to that book. Until we meet again, folk, goodbye.